Okay.
Here, I'll just move this over for you, and then you can kind of put it between us.
Okay. That's cool. It's probably still best for me to sit.
I could probably sit here.
Okay.
So, do you mind just saying I'm, and then your name, and then you were talking about Hawaiians, pride?
Richard Kaneho Libas. I'm part Hawaiian. And what I find interesting about Janice Duncan is that, you know, this is written in 1972, and she has the population estimated at 300,000. And, you know, one of the things that the Haoles tried to do early on was try to diminish the Hawaiians, their population, their ability to navigate 6,000-7,000 miles across the ocean to all these other island groups. And that just, particularly when Captain Cook showed up, they just were absolutely stunned that the this group of Polynesians had made it all the way this far north. And there are no stars. When you cross the equator, there are no stars to read. I mean, if you're in the southern hemisphere. And they were just absolutely fascinated. And they couldn't believe that they could actually have gotten there. And there, of course, there's the Kon-Tiki book about how the Polynesians this group of people might have come from South America. But the Hawaiians actually came from the Asian continent and navigated across, you know, something like 25,000 nautical miles. And also probably, because there's also all kinds of records of their voyages to North America. There's just similarities. The Macaw Indians, if you look at the Macaw Indians, they use the same kind of nets that the Hawaiians use. They have dugout canoes that they fish and out in sea with. Their petroglyphs are the same. And so, you know, it was just natural for the Hawaiians to travel on. I mean, if you sailed to Hawaii from the South Pacific, you almost had to head northeast and then tack back the other way with the trade winds. And so, and the Hawaiians also, logs. Throw a log out in the ocean from Washington or Oregon, it'll end up in Hawaii. Just washes up ashore. And so, you know, you see these trees come in, you know, and they actually, when the Europeans showed up, they actually had trees, canoes, double hull canoes that were made from pine trees and things like that that had come from the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, the Hawaiians must have traveled there because they knew the trees came there. And so a lot of people said that that wasn't the case. But anyway, the population was probably around 500,000 based on the land divisions that they had in Hawaii and the way that they managed their lands. All I can say about the Hawaiians in the Northwest is what is particularly this book, Kanakas, is the interesting thing is the observation by people who really Americans and other Europeans who came to the Northwest and who observed these people in their diaries, and usually with prejudice. I mean, they're prejudiced against any people that were brown. Are, you know, dark skinned, and they really were impressed at the ability of these Hawaiians, men and women. They're swimming, and there's just all kinds of unique stories. And if you look at the Hawaiian people and the way that they divided their land divisions and how they worked, is everybody had an important role up and down the land division, from the person who worked up in the mountain and quarried the rocks to make the adze, the stone tools. And then the farmer who would terrace the land and grow his taro and everything else. And then you had down below the fishing village. And from there, and everybody worked together as one group. And they competed amongst each other, each land division, to see who could produce the most. And what you find with what the Europeans found when they first encountered the Hawaiians was they were excellent navigators. And that's why they took them on the ships. Within days, they could learn how to sail even the largest ships. Then when they were brought over to Fort Vancouver, it was their swimming abilities, particularly when, you know, the ships would come to shore, they'd have to come out in these rowboats. And a lot of times they get tossed in the surf, and the Hawaiians were there to just basically save people out of the surf. There's some amazing stories in that book, The Kanaka, The Untold Story. One of them that's really amazing is that there's very little record of the old religion and how things were done. And there's actually in a diary, written in the diary of this one woman was observing this Hawaiian who had died trying to save these people that had fallen in the ocean, and he actually drug them out of them with his teeth, and he finally succumbed to exposure. But she also noted in her diary how they had buried him, what they did. They salted him. And these things, I mean, and they turned a certain way. A priest came, somebody who apparently was a priest came, a kahuna, and gave a Hawaiian ceremony, something you never see. That was all outlawed. It was forgotten. And that's what I find real interesting about that book. And it's good to give it to the Hawaiians that come here, because they don't know. A lot of them don't know about the Hawaiians that came to the Northwest. I mean, in the 1800s, I mean, you know, the 1805 and so, this land had to be, it was forested all the way down to the rivers. I mean, from the Willamette to the Columbia, it was dense, it was wet. It was just extremely hard to survive here. And these people were coming from an island where the temperatures were 70, 80 degrees. And yet they managed, and they did really well. And that's the thing about the Polynesians, the Hawaiians, they were very adaptable people. When Cook showed up in 1778, they had no written language. By 1840, they had a constitutional monarchy. That's quite a big jump from no written language to a constitutional monarchy with the right to vote. And they were adaptable. That's what made them survive. And they took those skills of adapting and went to the Pacific Northwest and adapted to those conditions in Fort Vancouver. For me, as Hawaiian, I take pride in that, because we've lost so much of our culture that there's not a lot of examples to go by, people that you could admire or look at to see how they did it. And so for me, the Kanakas in the Northwest is an interesting story.
So what's your story? Like, what's your, I mean, I know that you're part Hawaiian, and
yeah.
You've obviously studied quite a bit. Did you study Hawaiian history or Northwest history?
Well, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, the picture of that man right up there, came in Oregon in 1843. And then his rest of his family came in subsequent wagon trains and up through Klamath Falls, the original trail through there. He left Kentucky and Missouri $33,000 in debt from the bank failures of the 1830s. And when he died in 1870, he had $500,000 in wealth. And he went out into Forest Grove area, Yamhill County, started his homestead. He was a Holman. I'm a descendant of the Holman family. And so I have all this heritage that was passed to me by my grandmother on my father's side. My my grandmother was born in 1899 on 10th and Southeast Morrison Street, and at the age of 15, left home and ran away and went to New York. Her dad had been a theatrical agent in New Ziegfeld, and so she went to New York, and she started dancing in the Ziegfeld Follies, and eventually entertained up and down the West Coast at the Orpheum and the Fantasias and all these theaters doing vaudeville and stuff. And in 1926, her and a group of other entertainers were hired to come and rope in the Royal Hawaiian, which was the first big hotel that was built in Honolulu. It's a big pink one that you always see the pictures of. And she had fallen in love with the islands, and instead of returning back with the troops, she decided to stay. And my dad was 7 years old and was in a boarding home here in Portland. And so she wrote her dad, or telegraphed her father, told him to sell all our furs and get her money out of the bank and wire it to her and put her son on the boat. And so he came out to Hawaii, and it was 1926. And my mother and dad met during the war. My dad had gone, was in the Coast Guard when they bombed Pearl Harbor, and he was on the North Shore side, and immediately went into the Army Air Corps and was stationed at Schofield Barracks. My mother, whose father is this man right here, his name is Willie Kaneho, and he was the general foreman of the Parker Ranch, and it's one of the largest cattle ranches in the United States.
I just heard something go off, and I was like, what the heck was that?
Go ahead.
No, something's a...
Oh, you know...
Beeping.
What?
Not beeping, but just like a ring. Or there was. Now it's gone.
It's gone. You might have been picking
it
up.
It's like, ding!
Something for the mic.
Yeah.
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably.
That was could really be funny. Been, I'm all. Been, yeah. I'm like aliens all yeah, of a sudden.
And you probably picked it up for the refrigerator probably kicked on.
Oh, boss.
And it has kind of a high hum, I mean, pitch to it. Grandpa Willie Canillo was a Hawaiian cowboy, and he ran the ranch for 50 years. He was a general foreman, and he had 7 boys and 3 daughters, and my mom was the oldest of the 3 daughters. And part of the thing that she got from, I mean, my grandfather, when he became the general manager of the Parker Ranch, was that my mom was educated in the Catholic schools, and then was sent to Oahu to be educated there instead of being most, I mean, it was, she was the first person in her family to ever graduate from high school, and that was unique. All the other brothers, uncles and stuff, they all got put up on the ranch. It was hard work, very hard work, and it was very dangerous. Cattle ranching in Hawaii is in that it's all upslope and downslope, and the cattle like to run, and there's grassy, it's grassy and everything. I mean, really slope. I mean, Hawaii didn't have to cut any trees down or nothing. It's just naturally grassy, and it was an excellent place to raise cattle. And when King George sent Vancouver, Captain Vancouver, with cattle and sheep that he picked up in California to deliver to Kamehameha, and then Kamehameha, the sheep didn't make it, but some of the cattle did, and it was an awful mess inside the ship, I guess, and. But they let him go wild on the big island, and the Kamehameha put a taboo on him so that nobody could touch him. And they ran wild for about 30 or 40 years until they started to get out of control. They were starting to destroy the vegetation, I mean, other unique plants there. And so initially they started doing what they call, they hired Australian people from the penal colonies to hunt these cattle down. What they would do, they'd dig a hole, what they call a bull hole, and the cattle just fall on them and they catch them like that. It wasn't anything very, you know, they just wait, you know. But what's interesting, you know, is that David Douglas, he came to Hawaii in 1840, and he'd landed on the Puna side and was going to go over to Hilo, and he'd been warned to wait until somebody else went over. He was going to walk it, go across overland, and that's where he died. He fell in a bull hole. In 1840, yeah, David Douglas did. And up there on about 9,000 foot side of Mauna Kea, there's a monument up there that was put up 100 years later by a group of people. And they planted all these fir trees. And it's really quite unique. You come out in this opening, you know, and all of a sudden you can just smell Christmas trees. And you just look around and there's just all this stuff. And, you know, nobody knew about it. And even, I mean, I've been on the mountain a whole bunch, and I really had never paid attention to this one. You know, you go to Honolulu and you go to the tourist areas, and there's always this sign. It looks like a Hawaiian warrior, and he's pointing, you know, this way or that way to a tourist attraction. Well, you know, up here on the mountain, it's just this dirt road, and there's this sign up there. And I finally noticed it one day. And I go, Uncle, what is that? He goes, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know, Uncle? This is a man that his whole life was on this mountain, and he ranched, and he knew the whole area. He goes, well, I don't know. So we walked in, and we came out, and I was just stunned, because I'd grown up in Oregon, you know, David Douglas High School, and Douglas County, and all these things, you know, I never realized that that's where David Douglas had died. But, there you go.
In a bullhole.
In a bullhole, yeah.
Poor guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was gored and everything, but the cattle were released on the islands, and then eventually, to get control of the cattle, and also because they became a product that they could salt the meat, and these ships were coming back and forth and replenishing. Especially during what really made Hawaii's economy thrive for a long time was the whaling industry. They would replenish there and then go back out to sea and hunt the whales, and so that then they also wanted salted meat. And so they started bringing Spanish cowboys and vesqueros to Hawaii to train the Hawaiians how to be cowboys. And that's where they picked up the guitar and what's now the ukulele. The Portuguese brought this small little instrument that's now the ukulele, and the Spanish brought their big, big Spanish guitars. And in those 1860s and 1850s era, just to get strings, where you'd have to wait months and months and months for the ship to show up if you could get the strings. And so the Hawaiians, they tuned them the way they liked them, but they also tuned them down and slacked them, the keys, the strings, so they wouldn't break their strings. In that sense, that's where the term slack key comes from, which is a style of music the Hawaiians play. And Sam was a slack key master, and that was his other thing that he did for the Oregon Folklife, the Oregon Historical Society, was besides weaving, he also played slack key. And so that's where that all comes from, for Hawaiian cowboys. And so my grandfather was a cowboy, and he was also a kahuna. He was the keeper of the secrets, in the sense that on that mountain is the end of the Ice Age. The last of the Ice Age is up on top of Mauna Kea, where those observatories are, all those telescopes. And there's ice caves up there. And in those ice caves are some of the ancient Polynesian mariners that have been buried. And they're very, very, very tall, 8 feet tall. Yeah. And in the 1920s, Grandpa was persuaded, forced. What can you do when your boss tells you, the people that you work for, the Parker Ranch, the group of anthropologists and scientists from the Smithsonian came, and they asked him to take them into it, and he agreed to it, but he blindfolded them so they wouldn't know where the entrance to the cave was, and he took them in, and they took tissue samples and blindfolded them up and took them back out. And so that's been passed on to my uncle and then on to my cousin on one side of the family. And then there's caves up there with ancient people buried in them. And it's just, you don't want, it's like the American Indians. Our own oral history has been used against us because they don't believe in an oral history. And so Hawaiians are very careful about not letting too much be known about the ancient past. And a lot of it has died. I mean, the Hawaiians, after my grandfather, my uncles and my mother and all these people, they were told to forget it. They actually observed these people going up, the older Hawaiians going up and using the mountain for prayer and for medicinal purposes and collecting herbs and things like that. And it's all been lost. I mean, the University of Hawaii is struggling today to gather that information, just what they did up on the mountain and where things were. There's a picture of my grandfather, and it dated like in 1923, and he's standing up on a platform, heiau, which is an altar, and up on the mountain of Mauna Kea. And that site no longer exists, and nobody knows where it is. And it's the only known picture of any religious site on that whole mountain. And that mountain, Mauna Kea, which is a white mountain, because it gets snow on top of it, is a navigational mountain for the Polynesians, because it's so tall, and that's why those observatories are up there, and that's what that mountain was. And again, this is where the Hawaiians, they don't know their own culture. I've had to read this. I've actually had to go get books and learn the culture. And there's a wealth of information out there, as much as that can be available, but there's a lot to learn, and you can certainly learn a lot. I mean, but the Hawaiians are embarrassed. They're embarrassed to admit that they don't know anything. The only thing that they have is what they consider their culture is entertainment. And they do it for various reasons, a lot of times just because that's the way the families did things, entertain themselves as they have their luau's and their dance and their music and they play, but then they also incorporated that into a show, and that's all you really get. And then people don't know them. Sam has a pretty good knowledge of all the what the songs are about, the old songs. But the Hawaiians today don't know. They just sing the words. They don't know what the songs mean. If you come up and ask them, and they're embarrassed, and they get real quiet, they get real flat faced, and they just kind of shrug you off and don't, because they're embarrassed that they don't know. And it's not really their fault. It's been, they were forced not to speak their language. There was a time in Hawaii that you couldn't even name your child's first name, couldn't be Hawaiian. And so that's part of the reason why the Hawaiians have lost their culture. It's because of it, just this conspiracy, and it wasn't really a conspiracy, to eliminate the Hawaiians and their claim to their land, but eliminate their culture, violently just have them eventually assimilated within amongst all the Asian groups until they just sort of disappeared. And that slowly has happened. I mean, there's only a handful of Hawaiians that could actually say they're full-blooded Hawaiians, and I'm not sure if you could actually say there are any full-blooded Hawaiians, because, you know, prior to the Captain Cook showing up in 1778, which is really late in the discovery of the world, particularly in the Pacific. I mean, by 1692 or so, the Spaniards were regularly going from the Philippines to Mexico with gold. And there's Spaniards shipwrecked on Hawaii. That's why there's red-headed Hawaiians and there's blue-eyed Hawaiians. And it's not just because of the later mixing of plantation time, but that was going on way before. But mostly these people were assimilated into the ili'i, or the royal families, and mainly because they also understood breeding. I mean, if you keep breeding with the same people for a long enough period of time, you know, you got to introduce new blood. And there came a time in the Polynesians, in around 1300, that they stopped going back and forth inter-islands, island group to island group, demarcations to Tahiti, to Samoa, to Tongans, to the Maoris in New Zealand, to Rapa Nui, Eastern Island, and Hawaii. Before that, they were always traveling back and forth, intermarrying, and then it stopped. And there's a lot of reasons. There's a reason for it. There was a curse put on this island, and all the Polynesians stopped traveling. And they stopped sailing their double hull canoes, and they stopped doing that. There's Japanese that probably shipwrecked on Hawaii. There's Chinese that probably shipwrecked. I mean, Hawaiians had history of knowledge of metal, iron, steel. I mean, but they didn't have that capability. As soon as the ship started, the Hawaiians were constantly, when the first European ship showed up, the Hawaiians would dive down and pull the nails out of the ship. They could stay down that long. And that's what brought them to the Northwest, was their diving and swimming. And anytime something fell off a ship, it was a very important piece. And you'd have to go down and get it. And that's what they used the Hawaiians for, was to dive down and grab something. Then brought here, they were used for their lifeguarding capabilities. I mean, the ability to save people in surf, swimming. And then their honesty. If you look, what's interesting is that I don't have this particular book, and I wish I did, because I've been hunting for it. I went through every one of my books on pioneer women. And Narcissus Whitman had Hawaiian servants. And she really hated the American Indians in the Northwest. And she was, but she trusted, that's all she would have in her household. The only people she would allow in the household were the Hawaiians that worked for her. And she thought very highly of them and trusted them. And so did all the British. And it only after the Americans started coming into the territory, Oregon country, that it became a competition for labor. And then the Hawaiians were slowly eliminated, and laws were passed, including being able to marry. I mean, I think it was like in 1949, they finally eliminated the fact that a Hawaiian, they wouldn't recognize the marriage of a white man and a Hawaiian, or a Hawaiian and a white, was outlawed. Mm. And so my mother's marriage in 1946 to my dad, if in Oregon, wouldn't have been recognized as a legal marriage. So even though they say it's a marriage between a man and a woman, well, the Oregon Constitution always defined the marriage between a man and a woman. That's not true, because the Oregon Constitution defined it between only a particular race.
Hmm. When do you know when that got repealed?
Yeah, 1947, when they finally went back and got rid of all those old laws. Yeah, couldn't own land. That's because they worked for the British Trading Company, and of course they didn't trust the British, but basically they just discriminated against them because of the color of their skin. And it's kind of sad because, you know, my family, Matthew Deddy, which is one of my great uncles, he wrote the Oregon Constitution. He was part of the territorial government, provisional government, and so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I have real strong roots in Oregon from pioneer days. And, you know, and also being Hawaiian, I have a lot of interest in this.
That's interesting. Yeah. So and are you with a Hawaiian local community or that sort of thing? Is that how you know Sam?
Well, yeah. I mean, I met Sam. They were starting a club, an organization, when I first met Sam. And I was trying, they were teaching language. I wanted to learn the Hawaiian language. And that's how I met Sam. He was actually the one that was teaching the class. And we had some interest. We just sort of struck it off really well. And we found that we both had something to share. You know, I was learning the culture. I went to this, in 1990, I went to the islands, and they were having a ceremony at the Pu'ukohola, which is a heiau, which is Kamehameha's heiau on the big island, where he built, you know, to sacrifice his cousin.
Heiau.
It's a temple, they're made out of stone, rock. And this is where he kept his war god, Ku. And he built this temple to house that war god. And then he sacrificed his cousin, who had been given the government. Kamehameha got the war god, and his cousin got the control of the island. And he eventually sacrificed his cousin there. And but they had this, after Kamehameha died, he had several wives, but his favorite wife was Ka'amanu. And she never bore any children for him. But she became the regent of the government, and his son became the king. But because, you know, as long as Kamehameha was alive, he had a strong enough force that he could keep the Europeans and all the white people at bay and not decimate the people. And when he died, there was a huge void. And Ka'amanu actually was the strongest person to lead them. But the problem was, in the taboos, women could not eat with men. But men made all the food. It sounds weird today, but that's the way it worked. And she had to get rid of that taboo because, you know, it was hard to entertain and discuss politics and economics and everything and without having all that, you know, with that being an ability to do that, to be able to eat with men. So she threw out, the whole religion was thrown out in one day. All the heiaus were torn down, all the temple gods were destroyed, and it wasn't until 1990 they actually had the first sanctioned religious ceremony inside this heiau. And I went to it, and I'm watching all these things, and, you know, realizing right away that when I was invited, I didn't realize just how important it was, and that it was a private invitation, and that I'd been invited to come down and witness this. And they did this whole ceremony up there in the heiau, and they had a replica of the war god Ku they took up there and all this other stuff. And I sort of sat there and I'm going, gee, I really don't know anything, you know. And so I thought, well, the first place to start, you know, after all these years of being around Hawaiians and, you know, dealing with my uncles and being ranching, whole folk has always been about cattle ranching. That's what they did. But nobody, you know, nobody talked about the old religion and or anything about the past. You just forgot about it. Don't talk about it. Not important. What's important is now. And so I just was sitting there going, geez, here I am sitting witnessing this thing. And I come from a line of kahunas, kaniels. That's my grandfather. My mother's maiden name, kaniels, were kahunas from Kohala. And, you know, I've had this been told to me several times by old people, oh, no, your family are kahunas. And, you know, just sitting there going, I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm watching the Ka'amanu Society women. They're all dressed. They dress them all black. The black hats, and they got these orange feathered leis that wrap around their hats, and they're all weeping. And and a lot of people blame Ka'amanu for destroying the religion, but, you know, it was as soon as the Europeans showed up, it was a new world. Whatever the old world was, whatever their view of the way things were, it changed that day when Captain Cook showed up, and they had to become modernized. And Ka'amanu was responsible for bringing them into the modern world and not being overrun and disappearing, by bringing them into the world, new world. And but she was also accused of throwing out the old religion, and she became a Christian. And she allowed the missionaries to come and get their foothold into Hawaii. And the missionaries did a lot of damage. And eventually their grandchildren became the conspirators that overthrew the kingdom. And so, but anyway, back to Sam. I went and I took these language classes, and the language classes were really just simple conversational Hawaiian. I remember one time I called up my uncle. funny. He's actually my person I admire the most. There's been several songs written about him. He struggled. He's fought for sovereignty. Actually, what he's fought for is to put Hawaiians back on their land. And I always admired his fight because it was real simple. Very simple. He didn't have an agenda. And he didn't have an ego to win something or see. Just wanted to put Hawaiians on the land. And that's what he did. And so I called him up one day. And I started talking to him in Hawaiian. And there was just dead silence on the other side of the phone. And I go, "Uncle, I'm talking Hawaiian." "Oh." And I go, "Uncle, you talk Hawaiian, don't you?" "No." So I just, you know, end our conversation right there. I closed the book up, and we went off and talked about what his fight, struggle, protest on putting Hawaiians on the land. And then a few years later, I was on the island, Big Island, and I'm visiting and stuff, and we had to go over to Oahu, and we were in the airport. It was early in the morning. And a lot of people that work have to travel from the islands and actually fly over to Oahu every morning. That's how they travel. Yeah, and they have coupons. It's cheap. I mean, but you know, it's like $40 or $50 they pay for a round trip ticket. So when you consider the price of gas, it's almost equal. But we're in the airport, and all of a sudden I hear this old guy go, "Kaniho," and Uncle turned around, and they started walking towards each other, and they're speaking Hawaiian. And I mean, every other few words I could pick out was, you know, I know what that word is. And they talked and they talked and they talked, and finally he had to go. This plane was leaving, and when he got away, you know, I said, Uncle, "You didn't speak Hawaiian, you know." And he goes, "Oh, well, I don't speak Hawaiian, but the only way I can talk to him is if we talk in Hawaiian. But he has to start it out, and then I just fall into it." The cowboys were actually, the Hawaiian language stayed alive was on the ranches, because the cowboys were taught in Hawaiian, and they taught everybody else. You had to speak Hawaiian when you were being a cowboy. And so these old guys were cowboys when they were boys, when their dads put them up on the ranch. And so when they talk to each other, they speak in Hawaiian. It's the only way they can communicate. So I'm kind of at a loss at this. And I finally looked at him and go, "Uncle, let me ask you this. What language do you think in?" "Oh, Hawaiian." And it all kind of hit me, and I go, "I got it." You know, the thing about it is, Hawaiian language is only like 3,000 words, and so your thinking is very simplistic, the hardest thing my uncle has is listen to me talk, because I can rattle off ideas and things really rapid, and it's one thing after the other. You can't, you know, it's slow, and that's good, because you tend to make less mistakes. You tend to be more focused. You tend to less get, just, you know, yourself spread out to the point where you don't achieve anything. And that's how he managed to put a lot of Hawaiians back on the land, was being very single-minded and very just doing one thing and only one thing, and not getting, people would come to him, the sovereign movement, people would want him to join them, help them. But he said, "No, I'm more interested in just putting Hawaiians on their land." And there's a Hawaiian Homes program for Native Hawaiians, and the Hawaiians have been waiting. There's still thousands of Hawaiians waiting to get on land. And he would just go and squat. There's been land set aside for the Hawaiians to cattle ranch and to farm and to live on and stuff. So whenever my uncle would find a parcel of land that wasn't being leased out to the Hawaiians, that had been leased out to some non-Hawaiian, and they had vacated it, he'd go squat on it, throw his cattle out there. And he actually, for only person that's ever been able to litigate the Hawaiian Home Program, because it's a federal program, and only the Justice Department can sue on our behalf. Hawaiians have no, and when it comes to that program, the Hawaiians are nothing but beneficiaries at wards of the federal government. But he managed to prevail and went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won his case. And that as long as there's nobody on that land, that he can squat on it. And if they don't want him on the land, they need to lease it back out. So he was forcing them to put the next person on the list on that land by squatting on it.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, wow, it was just real brilliant. Simple. Brilliant, yeah. Yeah. And when they'd have to arrest him all the time, and this protest, you know, they'd take, you know, newspaper articles, and it just embarrassed the state, basically. It embarrassed the state. It forced the federal government to come back in the 1980s, and review its policies and how this whole program became a mess, and to admit to the fact that they're responsible for the program, that there's actually a person, that the person didn't even know it, that in the Department of Interior, his job description, one of his things in his job description was the Hawaiian Homes Program, and the guy didn't even know it was part of his job. And he became educated in that, and actually had a big committee come out, and the Department of Interior and the Inspector General, and found out the program had been abused and abused. It had been abused during territorial times. It had abused, and then when it was transferred to the state failed to do anything. And it's been a battle between the state and the federal government and who's responsible for the Hawaiians. And that's the problem. I mean, that's what my uncle did. He started just embarrassing it until it finally became news. Very little comes out of Hawaii. That's the other problem is that people don't know anything about Hawaii. They don't know anything about the Hawaiian struggle. It's kept over there. A few years ago, a native Hawaiian who was being evicted from his home because he couldn't pay his mortgage. Put you on land, but they originally were supposed to help. The whole act was supposed to rehabilitate the native Hawaiians. They'd been dispossessed from their land. They were undereducated. They had no jobs. It had gotten into worse, the terrible conditions. And this was supposed to rehabilitate them, and they were supposed to give them land and home. But the government, federal state doesn't have the money to build a house. So you get this land, and then you're supposed to get a mortgage and build a house. Well, the Hawaiians can't. But they had the money, right? Anyway, they would be able to build a house. But anyway, you know, eventually he lost in court, and he was going to had to move out, and he eventually just squatted on it, and they finally came to evict him. And when they had the state come out with a couple of forklifts to move his stuff out on pallets into trucks, and when they showed up, he ran in back into the house with a gallon of gasoline, ignited the house, and died in it.
Jeez.
Yeah. Protesting it. Yeah. And, you know, at first the county police that were there wouldn't let one of the workers, state workers, you know, go in and try to get him out. And finally the house was so engulfed that the guy took his forklift and punched into the side of the house where he'd gone in. But by then it was too late. He was already dead. So, you know, then not a word of that.
Yeah. No. I've heard of the, I didn't know what it was called or anything, but I've heard of the Hawaiians being able to apply and get
for native Hawaiian
blood,
right.
Had a certain percentage black one. Of Hawaiian blood. I mean, I remember hearing about that.
Right.
I remember seeing something about it. I don't know what it was.
Right.
But I don't know anything else about it. And the other thing else about Hawaii is just, you know, when friends of mine go there.
And
it's good hiking. You know, I mean, that's hiking. It, really.
I know. That's what everybody seems to remember about Hawaii is the beaches. And
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Right. And there's a struggle. Hawaiians are fighting. And
yeah.
Struggling for sovereignty. There's been several, the Akaka bill has been introduced several times in the U.S. Senate, giving the Hawaiians Native American status. And there's been a lot of people opposed to it, including the Native Americans, because
is the relationship between Native Americans and Hawaiians?
Well, in 1978 and 77, the Indians came to Hawaii to talk to them, along with the Alaskan Aleutian Indians, Native Americans up there, to all go as one. To the federal government and to get, you know, change, give them more rights. Actually, there was a big change in the laws in 1978 for Native Americans. Just one second, I'll show you the book.
Okay.
Take this with you. This one, this is the Native Hawaiian Rights Handbook. And, in this section right here, federal programs and benefits for Native Hawaiians. And the American Indians came in 1978, and it talks a little bit about this, about them coming, or at least what happened in that act. In 1978, there was a huge change in the American Indians Act, and also included with were things for Native Hawaiians. But the Hawaiians sort of dismissed the Indians and said, well, our situation's different. The Hawaiians have no Hawaiians have no treaty. There's never been anything signed that they've given up their rights. to sovereignty, to control their lands. When, and you can have this. This is the Queen's declaration or abdication of her crown to the United States government. And she never gave up her monarchy. She only turned it over until things could be resolved. It was only because I think Cleveland went out and Harrison came in, and then McKinley came in after him, and that the change of the presidencies, at one point they had sent a commissioner to evaluate, to investigate what had happened in the overthrow. And he had the power, and he ordered Sanford Dole and the other conspirators to return the kingdom back to the queen, and they refused. And he came back to Cleveland, and it was like an impasse. It was like, well, we can't actually send more troops and get these conspirators out. And so Cleveland handed it over to Congress in his address to them in 1900 and said that eventually, what was interesting, in his speech to Congress, he said if there had been an international body of law, like in what's now the United Nations, where the Hawaiians could go and argue their case, but there wasn't any place for them to go then, and that this was a violation of all international law. The Hawaiians, the monarchy had like 25 different treaties signed with all the major powers of the world recognizing their sovereignty when they were overthrown. And then in 1898, after five years after the overthrow, the United States took Hawaii from a resolution of the Spanish-American War. Took Hawaii along with all the Spanish possessions. They took Hawaii. Yeah, they took it as a territory. And they took the ceded lands, the crown lands that belonged to the monarchy, that were for the betterment of the people. They took that land and they put it into a trust and for the native people of Hawaii in 1898. And Hawaiians, like a territory, after the end of World War II, when the United Nations was created in the 1946 charter, it recognized all these indigenous people who had been colonized and all had their right to self-determination. The Puerto Ricans still have their right to self-determination. They can decide whether they want to become independent or if they want to become part of the United States, if the United States would want to take them or stay in the status they're at. But everybody had that right to make that decision, and including the Hawaiians. And without notifying the United Nations, they allowed a referendum to decide whether Hawaii wanted to become a state. And they let everybody vote, including all the military personnel. And the fact that they had allowed so many Americans to come in to Hawaii in violation of that UN charter. And they never notified the United Nations. They had this vote. And the Hawaiians voted against statehood. And but they're a minority. And 1959, Hawaii became a state, and it extinguished all their rights, except for, they have gone, and in theory, they've argued and successfully, but the international courts have no jurisdiction over the United States unless the United States allows jurisdiction over this particular issue, which they won't.
Yeah, right. Yes.
That's the whole argument about the tribunal court, the international tribunal, is that all of these things could come up, and including Hawaiians, and in fact, in 1997, in the United Nations, was the year of the indigenous people, and Senator Akaka, the U.S. Senator from Hawaii, was the keynote speaker, and Ambassador Albright was there and was blindsided by his speech because he was talking about the illegal overthrow and all these things and the rights that Hawaiians had to go to the United Nations and argue for their right to sovereignty. She said she had always thought that the Hawaiian situation was a domestic issue. And it's not, because Hawaiians have never had their rights extinguished. But there's no provision, there's no mechanism, there's nothing for a state to secede. And that's what, if you wanted to give the Hawaiians their sovereignty, true sovereignty, give them back their right to self-determination, it's too late. The deed's been done. And you can't reverse it. It will never happen. The best the Hawaiians can hope for, and under the Akaka Bill, is to get Native American status. That's their first step. Because the Hawaiians have been challenged. They actually have this program called the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And in 1978, see, this is what happened. 1978, the Indians were there, right? And there, we see the problem is that most of the land in Hawaii is being held in some form of trust. And so the Hawaiians were sort of tricked by people there saying, well, you don't need the Indians. We can just settle this matter here, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to create the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And this will be the interim government by which you'll be able to get sovereignty. Of course, and we'll take the Hawaiian Home Program and we'll incorporate that into it. And then you'll have this whole thing, and you'll have the beginnings of sovereignty. And so they dismissed the Indians, and the Indians left. And what's interesting is that one of the things that prevents the Secretary of Interior, particularly under the Clinton administration, who was the Secretary of Interior? I can't think of his name right now. The guy that's the Arizona, governor of Arizona, or New Mexico. But anyway, he was Secretary of Interior. But the Department of Interior can give sovereign status without the ratification of the Senate, can give it to them, okay? He has the power to do that. And that was one of the biggest changes in the 1978 change in the Native American Act. But it only includes the continuous states of North America. Includes Alaska and all the other 49, you know, all 49 states, but it excludes the Hawaiians from ever being able to get the Secretary of Interior to recognize them without going to Congress, which is, it's an impossible thing because there's just so many people. I mean, there's so many other burning issues to get through Congress, but the Akaka Bill has been introduced twice now, and it's been,
that's for Native American.
Yeah, that's to give Hawaiians Native American status, which would be the start. There's been several. OHA was created in 1978, and at that time, I refused to become a member or join OHA because I live here in the mainland, and OHA represents all Native Hawaiians, and they hold the trust. They hold all the money that's been given to the Hawaiians today until the rightful government can be reestablished, okay? And they have trustees. And what you do in Hawaii is you have a state election, and in that state election, Native Hawaiians get a special part of the election card where they vote for Hawaiian trust. I mean, the trustees. Well, and I've always felt that was unconstitutional because I can't vote for them here in Oregon, although they represent me. I can't vote for the trustees. And finally, this rancher, a white rancher who family goes all the way back to the kingdom times and the conspiracy, because the Hawaiians have gotten so vocal about throwing all the Haoles off, and there's been a lot of things that...
Haoles?
The whites, the non-foreigners, really.
I figured, but how do you spell it?
H-A-O-L-E, Haole. Yeah, the E. There's been a lot of people want to throw off, throw the whole, all the foreigners out, and there's been, in 1993, in commemoration of the 100-year overthrow of the monarchy, the governor of Hawaii ordered the American flag removed from the state capitol and for 3 days. And it angered a lot of white people, particularly those who, older people. And it's created this division amongst these radical Hawaiians and the rest of the population. And this one rancher finally tried to vote for OHA trustees because they have a portfolio of about $200 to $300 million that they control. And he tried to vote, and they wouldn't let him vote for the trustees, although he goes all the way back to the monarchy. His family were citizens of the monarchy. Okay? That's what was overthrown. And everybody had rights, equal rights, no matter whether you're Hawaiian or white or Chinese. You were citizens of the monarchy. So his family was as damaged as much as Hawaiians were. But it only recognizes Hawaiians, people with blood. Anyway, so he won. He went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they narrowly, there's the 14th Amendment, which protects civil rights and voting and stuff, and there's another, the 15th Amendment, says you cannot abridge the right to vote by race or whatever. And they threw out the OHA vote. So now the governor has to appoint the trustees. So Hawaiians don't really have control over this program, you see, because the governor, which is a political position that's voted upon all by everybody.
Instead of saying, say, okay, those whose families go back to the monarchy
right,
can was, vote, right. so that the two people or whatever on their
own whoever they want,
are
yeah.
the you know, exception to the right. rule, can vote, they instead throw out.
And that's family. Where you're dividing people between who have the blood and don't. Then you got the Hawaiian Homes Program, which, you know, you said there's a blood quantum. There is. The original act in 1920 had the blood quantum down to 1/64th, which included everybody that was Hawaiian. The blood quantum was really diminishing by in the 1920s, but the following year it was amended, and the only amendment to it was the blood quantum, and it was raised to 50%. Now you got, and that's a pretty high quantum.
It's very high.
Very high, considering what the you know Native Americans have. Now you've got somebody that's 49% Hawaiian, and you got somebody that's 50% or more, and they're the same, but they're now divided. And they fight amongst themselves over that. And this whole thing, well, you know, there's been a lot of people waiting that are 50% or more. And sovereignty would do away with that. And they're not willing to have that, lose their position where they've been waiting. So it's just divisive. It's discriminatory.
Do you think that all, I mean, this is an interesting idea that I hadn't known that mm-hmm. this is kind of like held in trust that the sovereignty could come back. Sort of was
right.
the idea, was
right.
her idea, and was the concept. Do most Hawaiians have that feeling?
They don't even know
even
about
underneath
it.
Underneath them.
It's only been the recent few years that they
you kind of know.
That they finally, but they if you ask them, they don't understand it. They're just beyond their capacity to understand it. They're too busy living their lives, just getting by.
Is there a feeling, though, of wanting to go back to Hawaii, of wanting to be there?
To restore their kingdom? I mean,
a feeling of...
We're
segueing really well.
The broken trust. Well, if the program had worked in 1920, there wouldn't be any call today for sovereignty. Because the Hawaiians would be on the land. Before you can have a sovereign nation, you have to have a land base. And before you can actually become sovereign, you have to restore your culture. And the land and the culture are tied together. Hawaiians become Hawaiians when they're back on the land. So, really, the answer is for the Hawaiian, rather than calling the one program that the Hawaiians do have, forgetting about the blood quantum, if all Hawaiians would stand together and fight for the Hawaiian Homes Program, for those that are 50% or more, and make that work, every boat would rise. Because if you know, before you became less than 50%, there was somebody ahead of you that was 50% or more in your family. So, there, you know, I'm not 50%, but all my other cousins, I have 42 first cousins because my dad was Haole and my mother is probably only about 85% Native Hawaiian. Okay? Chinese is mixed in there. And so I'm dropped down to about 42% or something like that, or 41%. So I'm eliminated. But my cousin, first cousin, well, all of them have their land or are on the waiting list. And mainly the reason they're on their land is because they live on the big island. The population is all on Oahu. There's 1.2 million people living in the state of Hawaii, and most of them live on Oahu, mostly the natives. And they can't move to the outer islands because there's just not enough jobs to support them. So they're waiting, most of them are waiting on Oahu for housing because that's what they need. More than anything else, they can't. They're dispossessed. They don't own anything. They're in poverty. You go to the coastline of Waianae, which is where the majority of the Hawaiians are. It looks like a rust belt. And going to Michigan, you know, to where the industrial revolution began and now has died. You know, the car automobile manufacturers. You know, when in the 80s, when they finally lost competition with the Japanese, you go there, Pontiac, Michigan, and it's just dirty, and it's just awful, and that's what Waianae looks like. It's just boarded up buildings, and now there's a problem with what they call ice, which is like crystal meth and cocaine, and it's horrible.
Yeah.
The Hawaiians are slowly being destroyed by that. But go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say. So I was just gonna kind of
Okay.
This is great, though, because I don't know anything about Hawaiian history.
Well, I mean,
I was going to ask about the community over here.
Yeah.
Like the Hawaiian community, not even necessarily ones who've been around forever, because I know there are, it's very difficult to find
right.
those.
There aren't very many.
If you do know of a couple, then that'd be great. If you know of anyone who has old family history here, Hawaiian. But also, I wanted to ask about the local Hawaiian community here.
There are, as far as I know, nobody traces their Hawaiian lineage from here. Or all the people that are here are from Hawaii and not...
In the last 50 years or so.
Yeah, and nobody comes from, that we know of, comes from the original Hawaiian settlers here. All those people mostly married into the Native Americans, like the Tsleil-Waututh and with the Kalama Indians, and up in Warm Springs, if you talk to them, the elders up there, they'll tell you where they are. They can identify them. But there's no organizations here that represent that group or anything. And there's only a few clubs, and they're made up of mostly, I mean, there are Hawaiians in the club, but they're just mostly social clubs. Sam and I have a 501c3, which was created in 1993 before the Congress changed with the Republican-controlled Congress. And there was, in the Native American Act, there were language classes for Native Hawaiians and money for that. And a group up in Tacoma had gotten a $500,000 grant to teach the Hawaiian language. And then we created a 501c3 here, and it was called Kauhana. And it's been dormant. Sam and I have control of it, and we use it. But the IRS allows us to stay dormant because it was originally created to get federal money. That's the purpose of it, so that we can start teaching the culture to Native people, Hawaiian blood. So they've allowed us to just be inactive, and we use it when Sam and I do cultural programs. We do them for the Oregon Historical Society, like for RAC, things like that. And we can use our 501c3, and we do get donations from people to just pay, defray some of the costs. We try to do things free for the Hawaiians. But mostly the Haole show up, and the Hawaiians don't. They don't see any value in it. They want to be Haoles. And it's sad, but, you know, if you live in an island where maybe about 7 to 8 million tourists come to your island annually, you want to be like them because they've got money. And so you start emulating them, and you want to be like them, and you want to have a car, and you want to have a nice house, and you want to be this and that. And but they lack the education. So they fight amongst themselves. That's the saddest part of all, is that because they have different ethnic groups. I mean, you got Chinese Hawaiians, you got Japanese Hawaiians, you've got Filipino Hawaiians, you've got Portuguese Hawaiians, and so on. And they seem to fight against each other amongst themselves ethnically. They don't get along as groups. And so that's what divides them more than anything here in the mainland, especially in Portland. I don't know why in Portland, but for Portland, it's pretty, you won't find much. Go up to Seattle, there's a lot of clubs and organizations. You go down into California, and there's tons of them all up and down California. Old ones, too, organizations. But Portland just doesn't seem to. There wasn't anything to draw people here originally, except for the schools. And so they never really, they're just in it. So I think Portland's really kind of, there's no one place they came to. If you looked at them, they're all over. Particularly on the west side, they're all over in Beaverton, in that area, spread out, and so they don't seem to stay very well organized. They have a club in Na Hawaii, which is a club.
I've heard of that. I just got that link today.
Yeah. Sam and I started that. That's how I met Sam.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, that was and Sam and I took away, we stopped because it was really just turning out to be a social club. And that's, you know, they still do things, but you can approach them, but they probably won't have anybody that can help you. I mean, most of them don't know the history.
So it's just a social thing.
Yeah, it's
just where in California is there?
Northern California? Down, yeah, San Francisco.
Okay.
And LA and San Diego, they're just up and down the West Coast.
Okay. And Seattle's good too.
And Seattle's good too, yes. Seattle, Tacoma.
I like excuses.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that made me think of one other thing. You mentioned, I mean, of course I'd known Aloha, or Aloha, however mm-hmm. we're supposed to say it. Mm-hmm. But do you know of any other place names around here that are Hawaiian?
Well, you know, not in the Oregon country. There's Kanaka Falls and Idaho and Kanaka Rapids and there's the Kalama, Washington, Friday's Harbor up in the Puget Sounds. Actually, they couldn't pronounce Hawaiian's name, so they called him Friday. And he was a sheep herder. And he started, and that's one of the stories in that book. He started had a sheep ranch going. And he built a big barn.
They saw the smoke from his...
There's fire. They would let him right into the harbor. And that's how it became known, Friday's Harbor. So, yeah, I mean, it's all just little stories. You know, the Hawaii River. But most of it's just been erased. I mean, the Hawaiians were just forgotten. Mm. And the contributions were huge. I mean, most of the domestic cattle came from Hawaii. And come over the trail. It wouldn't have survived. The fresh fruit came here from Hawaii originally.
But the fort, they're excavating this powder magazine,
mm-hmm.
and to make it, because they couldn't make the foundation out of wood, obviously,
mm-hmm.
they used rock,
mm-hmm.
but then to make the mortar in between the rock, they used coral
mm-hmm.
they brought over from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was just interesting, and
yeah.
So I felt that. I was like, look, you can see it's coral. What's it doing here?
Hawaii had a big contribution, because everybody stopped in Hawaii. That was even when they sailed out of around South America, they still sailed to Hawaii and stopped there before they went on to the Northwest, because there was nothing here. Just to replenish your boats, you know.
Yeah, wow. Well, very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for talking to me.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to think. So do you know some people who could do, like some artists, like say if I were looking for some Hawaiian music?
Yeah, I can find somebody.
You can find somebody.
Yeah, no, I can.
List.
I mean, they might not be able to talk too much about their culture or their history, but they can perform.
They wouldn't mind playing something.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Are there any Hawaiian storytellers at all that you know?
Well, not really. Sam's probably the biggest one here. I don't know of anybody, honest. That's the big thing. There's just not much to draw from.
Yeah, sure. I'm just trying to think of any of
mm-hmm.
anything else. Mm-hmm.